Welcome to the Purpose Unlocked podcast. We are your hosts. I'm Jennifer Winstall.
And I'm Leslie Kinchlow.
We're with the Winstall Kinchlow team in Charlotte, North Carolina. You can reach us at jennifer.winstall@ubs.com. We are financial advisors with UBS, one of the largest wealth managers in the world.
We are so excited to have meaningful conversations with a variety of guests. We'll be exploring their passions in business, entrepreneurship, and philanthropy.
Our mission is to bring purpose to life beyond the numbers.
Welcome back to the Purpose Unlocked podcast. We are thrilled to have Jay Malik with us today. Jay is an executive with over 30 years of experience developing and implementing investment platforms for large institutional investment firms. So, Jay, we've known each other many years.
It's many, so fun many, to many have years. You here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So you wrote a book recently.
I did.
And we would love to just have you tell our audience about Achieve Wealth and Happiness, why you wrote it, and what was your inspiration?
Yeah, I'd love to share the ideas. So if we go back to the origins of the book, or the research behind the book, there's two different reasons. One, why I did the research on the book, and then two, why I ultimately published the book. But and we'll just cut right to the chase. It tells the whole story from the beginning to the end, but the middle part is how you get from where you are to where it is ultimately you want to be from a wealth perspective. And wealth can be encapsulated in both monetary wealth and happiness. But it all started back in 1996 when I was at graduate school at New York University. I had read an article about a woman who cleaned homes who left $50 million to a women's college in upstate New York. And that is really what was the inspiration behind my working in the asset management business and the wealth management business and trying to understand how it is people are able to accumulate wealth. Does it have to do with income? Does it have to do with inheritance? Does it have to do with starting a business? Can you be a social worker, a person on a reasonably lower income level and still accumulate that kind of wealth? So that's really where the inspiration for the book came from. And to go cut right to the chase, how did this lady was cleaning homes, how did she potentially accumulate so much wealth on presumably a very low income? I go to the Berkshire Hathaway meetings every year and have been doing that since 2000 with Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. In an interview in 2018 with Becky Quick, he pretty much answered the question. It was shortly after that that I said, okay, now I have all the pieces and it's time to publish the book. And he said, her accumulating that kind of wealth could have been as easy as, has she put $10,000 in the S&P 500 in 1942? By 2018, that would have been worth $51 million. Oh. And by today, that would be worth over $100 million.
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah.
Well, and it really is a very action-oriented book that you've written. I mean, there's lots of steps to take, and you've got places to for the readers to write things down and take notes.
Yeah, that was one of the things is in order to truly understand the principles of wealth accumulation, one is to learn the ideas, but then two is to take action against the ideas. So that's the basis for all of the exercises in each chapter is to really help you to take the ideas and then, you know, figure out how to apply them directly into your life and then transform that into actions which ultimately lead to results, which is wealth and happiness.
So, Jay, did you draw on your banking experience of 23 plus years to write the book, or did you take a pause in between your first and second career to do the research to prepare for writing the book?
So, when I first heard the story, that's when I decided I was going to go put all my chips and go all in on learning about asset and wealth management. So that's where I started working for asset managers, both in the traditional and the alternative investment space or with managers like Blackstone or Carlyle or Apollo, but also firms like BlackRock or Invesco. But then I also started working for wealth management organizations, and I got to work with chief investment officers. So I would say the idea for the book came from when I read that article, which was extraordinary. And then the rest of my life really was focused on working inside asset and wealth management organizations.
Right.
So doing and working alongside the people that would know how to create wealth and study and learn and implement and do those types of things in real time and then apply it to my own life and then ultimately write a book that I could share the principles with everybody else.
One of the biggest and most important parts of what you're teaching is leaving it alone.
Yes.
Right? So that you enjoy the power of compounding.
Yes.
And we often in the industry, I think, hear about market timing.
Yes.
People want to take money out when they think we're at a high and, you know, no one ever gets it right. Right.
Yep.
You can't time the market.
And no, so, you can't. It's time in the market as opposed to trying to time the market.
Yeah.
One of the ideas I talk about, goals-based investing, and that's something I learned principally from a chief investment officer. His name was Ashvin Chabra. And he wrote a series of papers called Beyond Markowitz and then Beyond Markowitz Revisited. And then ultimately he put it out in a book called The Aspirational Investor. But he talks about breaking your assets into three different components. Mm-hmm. And the three components are your cash component. And that is where you really don't care what your return is. You just don't want to lose any of your money. So you put that into a money market mutual fund. Your emergency fund.
Right.
Or you could put it into T-bills where you're collecting a good almost 5%. Nowadays, your second bucket is your core bucket, and that's where you're trying to save for your retirement and college funds and weddings and, you know, just having a good life after you officially retire from the workforce. And that's where you're going to be investing in like stock and bond portfolios and just trying to keep your wealth up with, you know, everybody else in the country. And then the third bucket that he recommends is called an aspirational bucket. And that's where you take, you know, larger risks in order to try and, magnify mm-hmm. the success of your wealth account. But in that bucket are a lot of things like owning a business, because that business, you know, you got a lot of upside, but you also have a lot of downside if it doesn't work out very
well. Right, or crypto.
Crypto. Right. Bitcoin is a perfect example. Yeah. You could have, you know, 15 years ago, had 30 cents and it's now worth $110,000 per coin. That's insane. But it could also be stock options. It could be individual stock in a company, anywhere where you're trying to take a risk to try and have it grow faster than the market, but you're also willing, you also recognize that you could lose all of it in an instant. But if you manage your wealth into this idea of these three different buckets, you're really assuring yourself or giving yourself a better chance of actually achieving all of your wealth goals. Because like I said, the woman who was cleaning homes, she could have accumulated her wealth in multiple ways. And I really don't know the answer to how she did it. She could have owned a company of cleaning people. So she could have had 1,000 people mm-hmm. working under her, and her company could have grown to be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. She could have also been a very early investor in, you know, Google or NVIDIA or Bitcoin, or not Bitcoin at the time, but you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Something that would have really magnified mm-hmm. the wealth in a very concentrated manner. But what I found in my book is she could have also done it in the core portion of her portfolio mm-hmm. by just investing in a diversified, low-cost index fund like the S&P 500, putting the $10,000 in an S&P 500 in 1942 and forgetting it and just letting it compound to what became $51 million and a magnificent gift to a women's college in upstate New York, right? So it's really that easy if you think about it. And imagine how much wealth she would have had she not just put $10,000 once, but $10,000 every year for all those years. You would be talking billions of dollars.
We talk with clients a lot about debt.
Yeah.
And you write about that in your book, Good Debt versus Bad Debt.
Yep.
I think of it as leveraging your personal financial statement.
Yes.
I'd be curious if you could share with our listeners, you know, what's your perspective and how to approach debt?
Yeah. Everybody needs debt at some point in their life, but it needs to be used in a very constructive manner. So I go to the Berkshire Hathaway meetings, and Warren Buffett would say all the time, he's don't use too much leverage in whatever it is mm-hmm. you're doing. However, I don't recommend using credit cards at 27% to 29% interest rates.
We all made that mistake in college, right?
Right, we all made that
yes.
mistake. But it's going to sink you to have those types of debt. I don't generally like variable debt. I tend to like fixed debt. And if you can get fixed debt when interest rates are very low, mm-hmm. like we just came through a period of time where interest rates were at historic lows.
That's right.
And most Americans took advantage of that opportunity to refinance, for example, their mortgages down in the 3%
That's
range.
Right. Yep.
So, I mean, you put it into the context of I have a 3% mortgage, right, which is tax deductible, the interest. And I could then take the cash out of the house and invest it in a T-bill at 5.5% with no risk and complete liquidity. That kind of leverage, that kind of debt makes perfect sense to me. And I know there are some practitioners out there who say you should pay off all your debts. I don't think you should pay off debt like that. That is really good debt that you should have. However, if you have credit card debt at 27 to 29%, right, or you have other types of debt in the 12% or 15%, I think you should do everything you can to get rid of those debts by either paying them off or reconsolidating them down into a lower cost form of debt, maybe a HELOC or a mortgage that most people deal with. Just be careful with how you use leverage. One of the principles, I talk about it in the book, and I think it's really interesting, is is a home an asset or is it a liability? Mm-hmm. And the answer to that question is it's really a liability. And people go, no, it's an asset. Well, it's not. If you lose your job, you lose your income stream. The question is, can you make the mortgage payment? Mm-hmm. And if you take out a mortgage that has too high mm-hmm. a payment and you lose your job and you don't make that payment, that asset doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the bank, and you're going to lose everything. So you really have to be very careful about how much debt and leverage you take on relative to what your ability to service that debt is, even in the worst of times. So that's how I would generally think about it.
Yeah, I actually agree with everything you just said. And we kind of share with clients, cheap debt is an asset.
Is an asset, yeah.
And that takes a lot of teaching to get someone to understand how to use that debt to their advantage.
I 100% agree.
But unfortunately, I don't think we're in that situation today with rates where they are. And I don't know if we'll be there for a while, but we did have that window right after the COVID crisis. And
absolutely.
Those that refinanced are reaping those
benefits. And I had seen somewhere where it's almost like a Fannie and Freddie Mac. I think it's like 70%. It's a really high percentage of Americans refinance into the lower interest rate environment. And that is really the base reason why prices in real estate are so high, and because people are not willing to move.
That's
like,
right.
If you move, you'd have to sell,
selling your mortgage.
You're selling a 3% mortgage. You'd have to refinance it back in a 6-7% market environment, which is just not possible.
That's right.
Yeah. And just as an example, if you buy $1 million house, and I did a post on LinkedIn about this, if you buy $1 million house and you put 20% down, so you have an $800,000 mortgage, in order to service that mortgage, it's over $6,000 per month. So that's mm-hmm. extraordinary. But a lot of people are in $1 million houses and they probably have $1,500 to $2,500 mortgages. They're not going to leave in this market environment.
Yeah. Agree. Well, let's talk about the happiness part of your book, which was a really neat and also action-oriented part of your book. One of the things you talked about was identifying purpose.
Yes.
So what would you suggest to our readers if they're looking for their purpose? How can they identify that?
So it's critically important in your life, and the earlier you do this to identify your purpose, the more fulfillment you'll have in your life. So I think of someone like Warren Buffett, and Carol Loomis wrote a book, Tap Dancing to Work. He's doing what he loves, so it never feels like work. My wife, as we were talking about, is a travel agent. Her passion in life, her calling is travel. So now she's doing what her calling is. And there's three ways to think of your employment: as a job, as a career, or a calling. And if you can find your calling, most people think about it in terms of like the ministry. Ministers have a calling, but that's not true. If you're doing what you absolutely love, which is your calling, then it never feels like work. So also you need to understand, why are you here in this world? There is a purpose for all of us. And the one exercise I use in the book was about Alfred Nobel, who created the Nobel Prize. And there was his family was, they were the creators of dynamite. Mm-hmm. And there was a time in Alfred's life when his brother had passed away, and he was reading an obituary, but they had mistakenly said Alfred's name instead of his brother's name in reference to the obituary. And the obituary really talked about dynamite and all the destructive things it had done in the world, used in wars and to kill people and all this type of stuff. And he was horrified by being remembered that way. So what Alfred Nobel did was he rewrote his obituary for himself the way he wanted to be remembered. And then he lived into that new obituary. And that new obituary was where he came up with the idea of creating the Nobel Prize and inspiring people to do things for humanity and in the sciences, in the arts, in the literature, in the, and so all we remember Alfred Nobel for is all of these fantastic things that he inspired in terms of making the world a better place. Nobody really remembers him as the family that created dynamite. So that's one way to find your purpose, is to write. I know it sounds very strange, but to write the obituary the way you would want to be remembered. Imagine, like, you just imagine, let's say you died 2 days ago, and your best friend and your family is talking about you and your life and your impact on them and on the world. Is that the way you want to be remembered, right?
Yeah.
And if it's not, rewrite it and then live into the way you've just rewritten
you just
your obituary to be.
Create a roadmap,
It creates a roadmap and then live into it every day. And that changes everything in your life. It's amazing.
That is amazing.
So what's your biggest discovery in writing this book? Was there something you felt you didn't know, and when you started writing it, it was a lesson you learned? Or is there any mistakes you made along the way? And what did you find from your mistakes?
There's a lot of mistakes, right? Right. And life is, we're all making them, and we're constantly making them. We're going to continue to make them.
Right.
I'm a big fan in goal setting. So, you know, people who write down their goals, there was a professor up at in West Virginia who said that people who write down their goals will earn 9 times as much as people who don't write down their goals throughout their lifetime. That's
totally
critically important.
Yeah.
I really believe in vision boarding, you know, putting down on paper what it is you want your future to be. And then by doing that, you kind of live into it. The same with goals, vision boarding. All of these things. These are ways to really kind of focus yourself. When a plane goes from LAX, Los Angeles, out to Honolulu, it sets its goal before it ever leaves the ground of where the airport is that it's going to land. And it's going to get constantly pushed off of its track by the winds and by pilots, you know, like whatever. And something's going to make it move left, move right, and they have to just continually retrack it back onto where it is they want to ultimately be. And that makes all the difference in the world. And that you should be planning that out well in advance. The one thing I learned, you know, is that creating wealth is a lot easier than everybody, you know, thinks and or makes it out to be.
Right.
I mean, putting $10,000 aside one time, letting it ride and it grows to $51 million or $100 million, that's hard.
Phenomenal.
Right?
Yeah.
And then learning, well, people go, where am I going to get that $10,000? Well, it's as easy as stop drinking. Or, you know, instead of getting the coffee at Starbucks 2 times per day per, you know, $8 per thing.
Right.
If you go to the break room in your office, there's likely Starbucks coffee through the Keurig for free. And that right there is at least $500,000 over a lifetime habit. So change these little habits. Try to become 1% better each day. Put the money aside, be disciplined, learn the principles of wealth, and it's a lot easier than what people think. And it's the same with happiness. You know, Warren Buffett had said once on happiness, a key to happiness in relationships and life is low expectations. You know, we get disappointed when we set our expectations too high. So I have a 3-step process I use every day to try and be happy. The first is remind myself when I wake up in the morning, every day above ground is a great day. My expectation is as long as I'm alive and I woke up, I'm going to have a great day and I'm going to live into that idea. At the end of the day, I ask myself, have I been a blessing to everybody I met today? You know, and if I haven't, let's try and do a little bit better at that tomorrow. And then throughout the day, am I living in a completely awakened state? And am I really, you know, Einstein once said there are 2 ways to look at the world. One way is to look at it as though nothing's a miracle. And the other way is to look at the world as though everything is a miracle. Mm. You know, I mean, you see the flowers. I mean, do you stop and really notice the flowers or bees or, you know, the soft breeze on your face or
it's a sense of gratitude?
A sense of, and gratitude is part of it as well. Be grateful for everything. We all won in America. The Ovarian lottery, that's what Warren Buffett says.
So
we won by being born in America. Yes. You know, you have the greatest opportunity for advancement and success and happiness of anybody in the entire world. So start by being grateful for just where you were born.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. God, I love that.
Yeah.
And I've been reading a lot about that lately, probably with the change in government, but
Yeah.
We do. We are the superpower of the world, and I think that's often forgotten.
And mm-hmm. people really forget it. We are 5% of the world's population, but we're 25% of the world's gross domestic product. We're amazing.
We are
if
amazing.
You look at the MSCI yeah. World Index, it's made up 70% of the United States. Yeah. That's how yes. successful yeah. we are as an entity. Now, that's not a given that that'll be forever, mm-hmm. but be thankful for it and live into, you know, a state yeah. of gratitude and happiness and joy. And it's much easier. So I give a lot of exercises and ideas mm-hmm. on how to do that throughout the book. But yeah. one of it is to keep a gratitude journal.
Yes.
Yeah. yeah.
I have to lean into this for a minute because yeah. we talk about global diversification within a portfolio
uh-huh.
naturally. But yet we know in the United States, we tend to dominate markets.
We do.
So what's your position in your book around diversifying into other countries and what's your approach?
So it's a good question. I serve on a couple of advisory boards, one at Davidson College and one at University of California in San Diego. And the one in UC San Diego is focused on the wealth and the asset management business. And we've had lectures on this very key topic. And what's interesting is what makes the United States very special is our rule of law, mm-hmm. is our democracy, property right protections. You go to other parts of the world and those are not givens. And so that makes investing outside of the U.S. a little bit more tricky than investing in the United States. So one of the things I had said on the call, on the meeting we were on, was Warren Buffett pretty much principally invests in the United States for these mm-hmm. exact reasons, mm-hmm. right? Because your property rights are protected. You can't have a foreign government come in, which they do in a lot of South American countries or countries around Africa and even some countries, you know, in Asia, where they come and they take the rights, whether it's the property or the businesses or the of the people. Now, I'm a big fan of global diversification. The United States, I think it's probably going to rebalance back into a global portfolio is better than a domestic-centric portfolio. But for the last 10, 20 years, a domestic-centric portfolio yeah, was the way to go. I don't
sure.
think that's always going to be the case. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the reasons why, again, the U.S. markets do so well is because we're an entrepreneurial people. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a great rule of law. Lots of people come to America, to our universities, and they stay in the United States.
Right.
And when they create these great companies and this great wealth, they're allowed to keep it. Whereas in other parts mm-hmm. of the world, that might not be as much of a given.
Yeah, that's interesting. When you look at the construct of our economy, too,
yes.
it's very technology-oriented, right?
It is.
Versus many other parts of the world where it's maybe manufacturing or it's mining or natural resources.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah,
but it's not a given. And I think what makes America great and what will make America really powerful in the future is this focus on education and entrepreneurship and, you know, the willingness to take risks, fail, brush yourself off, yeah. get up, try again. And when you succeed, you get to keep the spoils of your success. And then in time, hopefully that should trickle back down to everybody. But everybody needs to realize that you won the ovarian lottery at birth. You were born in yeah. America. And if you were lucky enough to immigrate to America, you have this opportunity. There's opportunities all around you. You just need to awaken yourself up to those opportunities.
Right.
Interestingly, immigrants are much more likely to become millionaires in the United States than people that are born into the country. Because when you're born into the country, you have a sense of entitlement mm-hmm. and you think things should be given to you. People who come from foreign countries, they see, you know, that you can do anything. You can start any
right.
type of a business. You're as successful as the amount of effort you put in.
Mm-hmm.
And so they tend to see the opportunities all around them, whereas people born into the country begin to forget that there's opportunities all around them. So one of the things that I recommend people do is reset yourself into kind of like an immigrant mentality, which is you can do anything in this country if you choose to do it and you put the effort into it. So stop complaining, stop whining, get out there and just
go do
go do it. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I would love to end our session today with an excerpt from your book. I understand
sure.
you wrote it for your daughters.
Yes.
Jay has three daughters. And so if you would love to share that with our listening audience, and we are grateful for you being with us today.
Well,
and really appreciate all your wisdom.
Well,
and thank you for the book.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having me. It's such an honor to be here. As I had mentioned, I started the research on the book when I read about the woman who was cleaning homes, leaving $50 million to a women's college. And that just so inspired me to understand how it is she did it and understand how she did it, but then more importantly, how anybody can follow similar principles to achieve similar success. But when I decided to publish the book, as you mentioned, I have three daughters, and they have all read the book multiple times, and they apply all the principles in the book. But my daughter said, "Hey, Dad, could we write the praise on the book?" And one of the things, what they wrote on the inside cover was, "Growing up, our dad always provided us with opportunities and insights on how to achieve financial success. One of the greatest memories with our dad was when he took us each to the Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meetings to be in the presence of some of the most economically savvy people in the world. We were in our mid-teens when we attended our first meetings with our dad, and even though we didn't understand much, our dad was able to explain the messages to us in a way that we could implement the strategies in our lives even at such young ages. Reading this book and applying the ideas provided into your life will undoubtedly change the direction of how you will succeed financially moving forward." I use an example of my one daughter who just graduated from Chapel Hill and now works at Bank of America. She's only 21 years old, and she's already made three full contributions to her Roth IRA.
Excellent.
That's, you know, almost fabulous. $7,500 yeah. per year into what will be a tax-exempt investment. If the woman who's cleaning homes put $10,000 aside once, she's doing that almost every year, and she's only 21 years
Remarkable.
Old. Imagine how wealthy she will be just by using the simple principles
yes.
in the book. The other quote that I always like to leave people with, this is an interesting one, but it's how you should live your life from a happiness perspective. And it came from a movie called Joe Versus the Volcano, which
oh, yeah.
to me is not the greatest movie
yeah.
in the world,
I remember.
But it's maybe one of the most impactful quotes on my life. And in the movie, Meg Ryan's character is saying to Tom Hanks's character, she says, "My father says that almost the whole world is asleep. Everybody you know, everybody you see, everybody you talk to. He says that only a few people are awake, and they live in a state of constant, total amazement." So that's my suggestion for everybody, is be amazed. You know, live as though everything is a miracle. You know, be grateful for everything. Smile at people. You'll be surprised at how much smiling comes back at you. Be a blessing to everyone. And at the end of each day, ask yourself, have I been a blessing to everyone? And if you haven't been a blessing to everyone, try and be a little bit more mm-hmm. of a blessing to everyone the next day.
Jay, you're amazing.
Oh,
and thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you all. This was such an honor and a privilege.
Everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.